We've got guys with the answers here for sure. It's a weather and climate update. Larry Mueller here for WPR. Steve Ackerman, one of our guests for the rest of the show. He's the former vice chancellor for research and grad education at UW-Madison, emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, welcome back.
Yeah, it's great to be here again. Very happy for the last Monday of each month.
And John Martin with us as well, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
As we talk with these two guys, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about how meteorologists forecast visibility? That's something that comes up as we were just talking about the tugboats on the Mississippi River. You're wondering how hot this summer is going to be? I think it's going to be warmer. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, last week, Tuesday, I think, was the vernal equinox, was it not?
Yeah, 10:06 p.m. Tuesday night. Yeah,
they call that the start of spring.
Yeah.
The astronomical start of spring.
Yeah.
For weather people, it starts in March.
And we all saw, too, didn't we, that the first day of spring is one thing. The first spring day is quite another.
Well, well, I wonder first, why do forecasters differ from the equinox?
I think it's just the weather. We typically, you know, break it up into seasons, and so it's a lot easier to pick 3 months, even months. So, you know, winter's December, January, February, and then spring is March, April, and May.
Yeah.
And today we're getting, in the northern part of the state, we're getting 8 to 10 inches of snow, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
while it's raining.
Pretty intense event. And and it's hardly raining here anymore, even. It's pretty much seems like it's kind of quit, and not so quitting up north.
I brought my umbrella just in case.
Oh, did you?
Nothing worse than a weather guy in the rain without an umbrella.
Well, you know, this time of the year always seems to be known for dramatic weather. This year, you know, we had 70-degree days in southern Wisconsin, then last week we had a snowstorm. Mm-hmm. What causes the big temperature swings?
I think this is a very interesting time of year, as you say. It's one where we still have the winter residing really close to us, so that if there is not an excursion of warm, moist air from the south, which can happen increasingly as you get toward the equinox and past it, if we don't have one of them, then winter is kind of hovering over us. But as soon as something well-developed gets itself embedded in the central part of the United States, we can get strong southerly winds ahead of that storm and make us really, really warm. And so we have both, you know, the warmth isn't extreme. The cold still feels extreme. And so, but the contrast between the two, because the zone of contrast is so proximate to us, is always there in March, more than it is in February. You don't get warm. In January, you don't get warm. But in March, you can get warm or cold. It's really interesting.
And it's that contrast that really generates that nasty weather.
Exactly.
The high winds.
Although I think we got warm in February.
We did. This year was this year was weird across the board, as we all know. Almost 10 degrees above normal every day. I think it was 7.8 degrees above normal for the 90 days from December 1 to February 28th.
Yeah. And we had our first tornado in February
as
well.
Yeah, that's right.
I wasn't able to, but a lot of my golfing friends got out to say they could play golf in Wisconsin in February.
Yeah, unreal, isn't it? Just unreal.
March, they always say, what does it go? If it comes in like a lion.
Out like a lamb.
Hmm. Yeah, out like a lamb. Is there any truth to that at all?
And I think it mostly just highlights what you were just talking about, is that it's really the transition month from the cold season to the beginning of the warm season, and it comes in spurts, and it staggers towards the exit because it doesn't know when the winter is really over.
Yeah.
And this has been just the opposite. It came in like a lamb, and it's rather lion-like on the way out, depending on exactly where you are in the state.
Yeah.
And I think these are, Ann Pryor, my wife, was the state folklorist, and so we've looked at this in terms of weather lore. And I think this is one of those situations that really demonstrates weather is really important to our lives and always has been.
Yeah.
So before we really learned anything about numerical forecasting or physically understanding how the weather works, you know, these nice sayings have developed that kind of represent people's observations. And some of them were good. Red Sky at Night, Sailor's Delight has some physics in it. others in terms of the woolly bear. Makes you really wonder about how those things came up. Because there's no connection.
Right. Especially with human attention spans, what they are. You know, how did someone see something in October and remember in March when they saw it? I don't think so. But, you know, we're talking about a subject that a colleague of mine and I just had a proposal rejected for the time being at the National Science Foundation. But it's studying the interannual, that is year-to-year variability of the winter to spring transition. And we got some nice comments in the reviews, even though they rejected it. They said, this is a long understudied problem and things like that. So it's everybody has it on their mind, whether in the popular culture or in the science itself, but we haven't really dedicated much time to it in the science. So hopefully we'll get a better result on a second submission.
And you can join, if you'd like to submit a question, you can do that right now. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Springtime, is it the windiest season? Or it feels like
I think typically throughout the U.S., it's the windiest month.
Probably a good guess. Yeah, I would think so.
And again, it's back to that contrast between the warm and the cold air.
Yeah.
It's going to generate pressure gradients and generate wind.
Well, and spring is the time for flooding, and NOAA released its report. We're not going to get... Probably not going to get much flooding here in Wisconsin.
Well, there was no snow. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The whole upper Midwest, western Great Lakes states had the warmest winter in 132 years. And part of that complexion was a lack of snow. And that's what causes, you know, the flooding of the Red River of the north and places like that, the upper Mississippi. There's just no snow to drain in this year. And plus, it was warm all winter, so anything that fell melted right away. So
and this spring, they're not looking at a lot of precipitation either up in the north.
Yeah. No, they are in the south.
In the southeast. I think they're more like southeast is more like closer to normal. Mm.
Well, it's they're looking. I think Noah said they were going to. There was more chances for extreme rain, extreme flooding,
in the southeast.
In the southeast, than the than and we're not going to get that.
Yeah,
I mean, we're still in drought
conditions throughout most of the state.
Upper two thirds. At least are in drought conditions for sure. Well, you did speak about your predictions, I think, in your Wisconsin State Journal piece about this summer's weather. What do you see coming in the months ahead?
So it's a tough one because we're in this now transition between El Nino and La Nina. Mm. So we're in this what they call neutral state between those. I don't think it would be too risky to say we're going to be warmer than normal just because climate change is you know, leading to warmer temperatures.
I think we're in the 60 to 7% chance of that, too. I think if I saw the most recent April, May, June forecast from the Climate Prediction Center had a 60-ish or percent or higher than equal chances for warmer.
Yeah.
And I think about equal chances for wetter, so... Maybe nothing unusual in the rain, but a little warmer. And those two kind of go in hand. If that continues to go in that direction, if you stay dry, it's easier to be warmer in July, August, and September if you've had a dry ground all summer long because it's just easier for the ground to absorb radiation without the water on it. So.
Yeah.
Richard called, couldn't stay with us. He's wondering how the coming eclipse will affect the weather, if it has an effect on the weather, and if it's okay to look at the actual total eclipse without...
No. For that last question, the answer is definitely no. I know it's very exciting. The first solar eclipse that I saw back in 79, we didn't have those glasses, and so it was very tempting to do that, but you really should get the glasses. And those glasses are always around now, so it's really not hard to get.
But what about the weather? It's not going to. Is it going to affect the weather?
It doesn't affect the weather. I mean, it's too short. It's like a cloud going by. It doesn't stay around that that long. So
I think the other side of the coin is the one you have to worry about. How will the weather affect it? You know, and if you go to a place and you spend a couple of years planning for it, and it's cloudy. I think I might still be cool to see it be pretty much dark at midday, even if it is cloudy, but it wouldn't be the same, I would imagine.
Yeah, like I said, I've seen two of them, and both of them in open areas, Wyoming, and the other one in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. And to watch the zone of darkness coming at you is just phenomenal.
Yeah,
so if it's cloudy, which we're trying to go see it again this year, and we'll see.
Well, you know, was it National Geographic or might have been the Washington Post. It was a guy who has kind of made it his life's journey to see as many of those eclipses as he can. And he's seen an eclipse on every continent.
Wow, that's pretty neat.
That's.
But the shock and awe factor, he loves this shock and awe factor. Is there an awe factor?
I think there is. For me, that awe factor, I mean, just seeing the solar eclipse is amazing. Mm. The awe factor to me was to see that Terminator zone coming at you. I mean, it is just moving. You get to see how fast it moves.
Yeah.
And it was one thing I didn't expect, which is why it was so awesome to me.
I'd love to be in the open plains. I think, when was the last one we had here in Wisconsin that we could see?
Oh, boy, I don't.
Oh, 100%?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
A partial, not too.
We've had a few partials.
We had 80-plus percent in August of, was it 2019?
Yeah, right. Yeah, just before the COVID.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's kind of cool, too. I mean, if you look at what I really liked in those situations is you look at the shadow of trees.
Yeah, me too.
Sort of see it in the shadows.
It's not boring.
Right,
yeah,
it's not boring.
It is not boring. It's very obvious, and you think, wow, that's so cool.
Cool, right.
We are talking with Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys from the... both have originally and currently with the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, and they will answer your questions. Roger in Grantsburg, we'll get to you in a couple of minutes right after we take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us. And there's a line open for you, the number to call 800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to ideas@WPR.org. We'll be back right after this quick look at the news. Stay with us. It's a weather and climate update for you for the next 25 minutes or so here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest Steve Ackerman, the former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison, also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin is professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So what do you want to know about maybe how meteorologists forecast visibility? Are you wondering how hot this summer is going to be? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. And let's go to Roger in Grantsburg. Roger, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. How are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call.
You should come up to Grantsburg. It's snowing. The snowflakes are the size of Chrysler's. It was just coming down here a few minutes ago. I was like, oh, my God, they're like half dollars.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
That's like 50 to 100 of them stuck together.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you can make snowballs out of anything out here. We've got about, I don't know, it must have been about eight inches now, but it melted down, you know.
Yeah.
It melted down about six or so. But my question is, I live out here in the heart of flyover land. I mean, there's nothing here around me. It's wide open. The contrails from airplanes. I do a lot in the field out here working. I see contrails from planes going over here constantly, probably 50, 75 planes a day, you know, maybe 100. And the contrails always seem to form into cloud banks after a while. Is there anything with the contrails that changes our the cloud patterns and weather patterns, and is there anything that they seem to enhance it?
That's a really good question. And it there was a NASA experiment that I was actually part of in 1996 to look at this issue. So that when contrails form, they are a combination of condensation trails coming out of the back of the jets, and it's the hot, hot moist air coming out of the jet that forms these clouds to form, and sometimes they dissipate. Mostly they dissipate, but there are times if the atmospheric conditions are just right that they could spread out into a thin cirrus shield. But the atmospheric conditions have to be just right, and by that I mean the humidity and the temperature in order for those contrails to generally spread.
So do they have effect on the weather?
I wouldn't call it effect on the weather in the sense that when they dissipate, they're clearly not.
Yeah.
If they spread into a contrail, then they can reduce the incoming solar radiation that might be reaching the surface. So it would be a thin cirrus kind of day, but that's not really going to lead to any kind of precipitation or anything.
But that would be a cooling effect, too.
It would be a cooling effect.
Right, and then at night, the cirrus clouds warm a little bit. Yes, okay, yeah. So they can switch off a little bit.
Yeah, but then if they're going to do that, they got to stay around a long time.
Yeah. And the cloud fraction that these things represent, I imagine, is really small compared to all
unless
clouds.
Unless they, the conditions of the atmosphere are already primed to have a thin cirrus. They're just looking for something to kick it off.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So there you go, Roger. And I advise you to go outside and stick out your tongue and capture some of those big snowflakes that are coming down.
And keep looking up. I'm guessing your mice being in a major flight zone.
That's why
you're seeing so many of them.
Yeah.
Thanks, Roger. Dave in Sussex, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. I got two questions. One is, can you predict if next winter will be as mild as this last winter? And the second question is, what does it mean when they say a 50% chance of showers? Is that 50% chance where you're at or over a big area? Or can you help explain that for me, please? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'll take the first one and leave it time for the second one. You can think about how to explain that because it is kind of tricky. But, I don't think – I think we're pretty confident in saying that this winter is not going to be like this past winter for a couple of reasons. We were in El Nino last year and we're transitioning into a La Nina. But also this past winter was so unusual that I think to match it back-to-back is going to be really not likely.
Yeah, just to follow up.
Much less than a 50-50 chance.
I would agree 100%. I'll follow up before I go to the second question. I think the frequency at which we are visited by such unusual winters, though, will increase. It doesn't mean we'll get another one next year. I think I agree with Steve on that. The 50% risk of showers. I believe the Weather Service, when they issue that, and I don't know what happens if it gets kind of transmuted a little bit in its meaning when it goes to a radio station or a TV station, but I know the Weather Service, I think, means that it is a combination of, 50% of the county warning area, which is a relatively small region of the state, wherever you happen to be living where you get that information. They say, there's a chance, about a 50-50 chance that someplace in this area will get a shower this afternoon, and or if you have the exact same conditions 10 times, 5 times out of those 10, there's going to be showers in the area. So that's kind of the way that I think that's actually meant to be, that's the information that's meant to be conveyed. Yeah.
Okay, there we go. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate the call. Dean in Colorado. Your turn. Hi, Dean. Oh, I think we have Dan. Well, Dean, we'll get to you. We have Dan in Stevens Point. Dan, hi.
Hi. I am an environmentalist, have been for a lot of years, but recently I have shifted from being an environmentalist to being a person so concerned about the change in climate that has been the main focus of my activity. I was wondering what the two of you thought about what we as environmentalists, as people concerned about climate change, what we should do to deal with this massive change in our environment.
Those are really good questions. I think there are a couple of things. One is, deal with it at a personal level. So if you can minimize driving, emitting gas, burning gas, that's a good thing. Recycling is a good thing. And I think the other thing that's important to do is vote. Make sure that you're getting representatives in there that stand for what you believe in.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. We were sort of talking about a related issue off the air. the idea that, you know, as I get older, and I'm the youngest guy in this room, I'll say that right now, but we're all of an age where we just don't want to take any more nonsense from people who deny the obvious. Yeah. When I first got to Wisconsin 30 years ago, I thought that climate was going to be slapping my kids in the face in their professional lives, but it's hitting me as I'm getting near the end of my professional life. This has come on a lot stronger and a lot more robustly than I think any of us thought even 30 years ago. So anyone who denies that now does not belong anywhere near representative government. So that's, I'm just going to echo Steve's comment on that.
And the other thing I would answer is, don't give up. You know, don't get tired and say, oh, you know, forget about this. I'm going to just stay at home and drink beer. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Yeah. But
there you go, Dan. Thank you so much for calling. Now let's go to Dean in Colorado. Hi, Dean.
Well, since the time you've called, I've called, and we've gotten another couple inches of snow, so we're really piling it on out here.
Yeah,
yeah. And I heard the Rockies is really getting a lot of snow again
right now. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah, we were near and a little above average, and here on the Front Range, we're just west of Denver. We got hit with a big orographic event, or upswoop, we call it colloquially, and. That's when winds coming in and meeting the mountains and clouds form as moisture tries to climb over the mountains. So we picked up almost 40 inches on that one last week. So we're still digging out. But, you know, all that was, I was kidding with my wife about this because we've had a pretty warm winter. And we were watching the harbor cam at Bayfield up there on Lake Superior. In your state, and they were doing a polar bear plunge, but there was hardly any ice. They didn't have to top anything. And it was completely bare, no snow at all. And I had to ask my wife, you know, I wonder how much longer the Groundhog Day is going to be a relevant point.
Yeah.
Well, personally, I don't think the groundhog, I mean, the groundhog, you can validate their forecast, and the groundhog is right 40% of the time.
Which is nearly impossible. It's like making a casino go bankrupt. You know, people can do it, as we know, but it's not easy.
I mean, it's a very entertaining, fun festivity and great movie, but as a forecaster, you'd almost want to go against what the groundhog.
Yeah,
you'd do better if
you went
against
it. You would. You flat out would. Yeah, but that's right. There was Lake Superior, I think, had only 2.7% ice coverage all winter long. And the average for the lakes was just around 2%. Lake Superior carries a lot of weight. But absolutely right. Absolutely nothing going on here. And then you guys always get your Thanksgiving and your Easter week snowstorms. So this is right on schedule. So you knew that was coming.
Yeah.
And we do have a changing climate, Dean.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Martin, who is north of Green Bay, has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Martin.
Hello. Hello, Larry and Weatherman. I just wanted to bring up a point to clarify something. You know, I hear this contrails used a lot, and then some people mix it up with chemical trails, you know, where they're actually seeding clouds. And, of course, there's all sorts of conspiracies about they're putting all sorts of chemicals in the air. Anyways, back to the contrails. Which, of course, I know you guys understand this. I just want to state it, though. It's short for condensation trails.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing that comes out of automobile exhaust in the wintertime. You can see it because when it's cold out, or your furnace exhaust. Because anytime you burn a hydrocarbon, which contains hydrogen and carbon, the hydrogen combines with oxygen when it's burnt and produces water. And it's the same thing that's happening when a jet flies up in the air. If it's at a point where it's cold enough, it will condense and make those trails, and that's what they're called, contrails. It's water vapor that's condensing after the combustion of the hydrocarbon that makes the jet move. And I just wanted to state that because it seems like, you know, these things get all mixed up, and, you know, there's just so much crazy ideas about some of the stuff these days that can just be simply explained.
Yeah.
Right on target.
And chemtrails, you know, it's a combination of chemical trails, which, again, are a conspiracy theory. These are not something the government's doing with regard to spraying. In fact, there's a lot of photos during World War II of the bombers generating contrails, and that was a real concern because you can identify where they are.
Right. That's right.
So it's been around for a long time.
And if you were going to seed clouds, you wouldn't do it from 38,000 feet.
That's right.
It's the worst place you could possibly do it.
Right.
Martin, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Elizabeth in Poinette emailed, so many weather apps offer 15 days and beyond forecast. Is there any accuracy beyond a week to 10 days?
That's a very reasonable question. I think there are times when you can get a reasonable complexion of a day, 2 weeks downstream painted, but I don't think you should count on it. I think you, if you were really keeping score, you might say, hey, there's one, that was a success, and here's another one, and maybe that would total maybe 20-ish percent at the high end. But from 5 to 7 days, boy, the percentage goes way up. You're talking about high 80% in terms of doing exactly that, accurately painting the complexion of the day. So it does, it tapers off rapidly after about 7 days. That's true. And it may, that may never change.
And one other thing I want to point out about weather, this came up in a web conversation I had with a couple of meteorologists. Those weather apps, which are great, there are many of them. Many of us use them. I use several of them. All that data comes from the National Weather
Service.
That's right.
That's right.
Nobody's it's not doing coming from the public. They're taking that data because it's freely available.
Right.
And that's really important, I think, that we don't forget that.
Yeah.
And it's important that we have it.
That we have it.
Yeah,
because if you don't, you're paying for those apps.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Kim, well, Kim sent us an email. She believes there was a total solar eclipse in the late 70s, but there might have been others since 1979, but I left, moved away from Wisconsin, so she doesn't know. But so 78, 79. Yeah,
the one that I saw in North Dakota was in 79. Now, whether I don't know, remember what the path was.
Yeah, I don't either. Yeah. I know it didn't get New England. That's all I know. I was kind of disappointed. So,
Dave in Sherwood recently saw a graph showing the past 9 months being significantly warmer than not only historical averages, but even compared to recent record averages. As climatologists, are you concerned, as Dave is, about the ecological impacts on our forests and agriculture?
I think, I mean, you think about the global warming that's occurring. I mean, it's regional, and it is impacting our ecosystem. I mean, it was interesting this past month, you know, talking to people who ran family maple syrup. Tapping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. We were just talking about that.
And they were doing
that,
it really, like in some of them did it in February.
Yeah.
You know, which is
actually even the end of January.
Even the end
unbelievable.
Of January. It's just, that's just amazing.
And then if you've been doing that for years and you take a vacation or you plan to do some other kind of work on the farm in January, you lose those 2 weeks
right.
and you're done for the season.
Yeah. Yeah. There was
that
a
is bad news.
There was a piece in the Washington Post about somebody who was gone on vacation, they were in Florida, and then they got a call saying, hey, the sap is running.
Right,
and they had this huge operation. They had to immediately race back to Wisconsin.
I'm telling you.
And they lost some sap because they just weren't ready at the end of January.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. Francis emailed us. They wish one of the things that was suggested that people can do on an individual, personal level to address climate change would be to reduce their meat consumption. Meat production produces a very large amount of greenhouse gases and can be easily reduced through what you put on your plate.
Well, that's a good point, and it goes back to doing personally what's important. Mm-hmm. The thing I'll add to that, as you were saying that, Larry, is there's a lot of studies now looking at methane production, and a lot of that in terms of cattle raising as well.
Somebody else is wondering, how big a relationship do seasons have with each other? In other words, if we have a warmer winter, does that mean our summer is going to be warm too, or spring?
No, there's not a really strong relationship because the atmosphere has very short memory. It doesn't have, you know, it doesn't we're not going to remember even a month from now that the winter was warm in terms of the atmosphere.
Yeah, we'll remember.
We'll remember it, yeah, but the atmosphere won't. Okay. And so the consequence is it almost doesn't matter back a certain amount of time what happened in the prior weeks or days or months. And so that's generally the way it is. Now, if you live near a large body of water and you have a particularly warm summer, you might well have a slightly warmer than normal fall into the winter because the water's taking a little longer to cool down. And so those kind of things, they happen. On the global or continental scale, probably less. So,
you might find visibility predictions where you get your weather forecast. Why does the National Weather Service monitor visibility, and how do they do it?
They do it now pretty modernized in the sense that they have small instruments that look at the they shoot a laser through a small volume of the atmosphere, and then they look at the scattering pattern. How does that laser change? And there's a lot of physics behind that to understand how that pattern changes is directly related to visibility. So that's how they primarily do it. It's obviously important in terms of any kind of travel. If you're traveling in a car or taking off in a plane, that's really going to be an important weather parameter you're going to want to look at. And they do have some, not some automated observations at airports, so they still have some humans making those observations, which I think are pretty tricky.
It is. I think my brother was a weather observer in the Air Force, and he said the way that he was lucky to be down in Tacoma at McCord Air Force Base, and Mount Rainier was right there.
So, yeah.
You can tell what the cloud heights were. He said the heights were not difficult because you had this beautiful marker that you can quickly develop that skill. But I think for visibility in the horizontal, I think the observers do the same thing. They're at the same spot. Like if they're at Dane County Airport, they know that they can't see a certain set of structures or hills if it's less than a quarter mile and so on. So they use that.
That sort of, and what factors in the environment impact visibility?
Water vapor content in the air. Yeah. So that's a direct measurement too, the humidity and not only the relative humidity, but the actual water vapor content directly.
Dust storms, dust and smoke, things like that.
And likelihood of fog would be related to all three of them.
And I was thinking, just reminded of this, because climate change has come up a few times, your story on hardiness zones.
Yeah, so that was something that in November of this past year, the USDA changed their plant hardiness zones. Just looking at that, because I do flower gardening and looking at where we are. And we're one of those regions in the U.S. where there's most zones in the U.S. either went to a warmer climate by a half a zone. We went, I think, from 5B to 5A or the other way around.
Or they
stayed the same. Mm. Nobody went to a colder zone.
Yeah.
They do this every few years. The NOAA does their up their normal temperatures every 10 years. And they did that in 2020, I guess.
Yeah, probably right.
Yeah.
And wasn't there something else about the hardiness? This is the biggest region that had an update of its zone.
Yes.
Over the whole country. It was a huge fraction, 40% or more of the country actually had a warmer zone or a less hoddy zone.
And here we are now coming into tornado season. Generally starts.
Already past that. It started in February.
I know it started in February, but April is gonna.
Big months are coming.
Yeah. They're really on their way.
And that's going to give us a lot to talk about in the coming months.
I'm sure of that.
Guys, thanks so much for being with us today. It's always a pleasure.
We'll do it
again the last Monday of April.
Yeah. All right.
We'll probably have had a tornado or two by that.
Hopefully Hopefully in a forest or a plane.
Right. Or over the ocean, a water spout or something. Yeah.
Right. Not here.
No.
Oh, boy. Steve Ackerman is former Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW, also a member of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. He's an emeritus professor there. John Martin, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. They will be back the last Monday in April, and we will do this all over again with them, but probably talking about different things. Tomorrow on the show, Patricia McConnell returns for our pet care show. She'll give us some tips on how to teach your dog recall and what to do if your dog won't stop barking, and I'm sure a whole lot more. So that's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller.